Hey, listeners, you're listening to KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you might be listening on KGVM.org. This is Desert Oracle Radio Replay, and I'm Roxana. I'm continuing to enjoy these very interesting days of September. It's often that little thunderstorms will rise up and give us a shower and then go away. In fact, I just heard some thunder just a bit ago. The chickadees have found the bird seed that's laced with cayenne pepper that I put out this time of year. The cayenne pepper discourages bears. And I just put out a little bit of birdseed at a time right now, so there's not going to be a big temptation for bears, even if they like their food hot and spicy, because I don't want to get them in trouble. Juncos are also frequenting my feeders, and in the background, I often am hearing Cassin's vireos, which have a sweet little song. Now, those birds are new to me. I don't know how long they're going to stick around, but I'm appreciating them while they're here, and I've even gotten to see one close up. They are the cutest little birds. What kind of birds have you been seeing? Last week on Saturday, my husband and I took a bike ride. And the first thing we saw, as far as wildlife goes, was a bull moose that was cutting us off on the little one-way road we were on. We stopped our bikes and let him get ahead of us and trot down the road and then go off into the woods on the opposite side of the road. And we kept riding our bikes, and there was a hawk that was scrambling around in the treetops. It was being chased by a kingbird. I couldn't identify the hawk, but it was quite a sight to see. We also saw a pair of red-tailed hawks that were on a thermal, and they were talking to each other, and it's such a nice sound to hear. We also saw a couple of, it looked like adult turkeys, with about six or seven young ones following them. So I don't know if that was two hens and their broods just hanging out together or what, but if you're a specialist in turkey behavior, let me know what you think. This week, the subject's a little different than what we usually talk about in our Desert Oracle Radio episode. It is titled The Landers Earthquake of 1992. And after that, we're going to talk about how our region is subject to earthquakes also. So I hope you enjoy that discussion. We're also going to have a little more about raptors from Steve Hoffman. But for now, enjoy the episode. It was produced by Ken Lane on September 29th, 2017. Enjoy.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the American desert. Do you remember the Landers earthquake? June 28, 1992. The biggest quake to shake California. In 65 years, a magnitude 7.3 officially designated violent on the Mercalli scale. Landers, on the northern outskirts of the high desert town of Yucca Valley, if you're headed north on Highway 247, is a sparsely populated land of Joshua trees and dry rolling hills. It's beautiful up there, and it still feels wild. Sure, you might have a nice designer couple from Echo Park and one neighboring cabin, but the other two still might house the old high desert. The one where you could live so cheaply as to entertain the most philosophical approaches to life. or the most criminal. Landers is something else. Well, in 1992, there were some artists and nudists and UFO cultists and Buddhists living up around Landers, as is even more so the case today, but mostly there were people who were attracted to the desert life for reasons deep within them. People who perhaps did not care to talk about such things, people who perhaps had run from something within or without, some hassle, some intractable problem, or maybe just boredom with a pretty dull system day by day. It was easier in some ways in 1992. You could still rent a shack or open a savings account without a credit report. You could live on cash dollars. If all else fails, you could cash your Social Security or military retirement or public services union pension check right there at the Stater Brothers. And you know, in 1992, you could still stop by the SoCal Edison office on the 247 and pay your electric bill with a 20. Of course, now you can toss up a couple of solar panels and say goodbye to the utility bill forever, if you want. And you can have a cell phone, if you want. You can sit in your nice old homestead cabin and look at the same TV as everybody else in every other form of human habitation. And when a 7.3 earthquake strikes, even an officially violent one, a benefit of mostly sort of built-to-code one-story structures far from one another is that a big quake just can't do as much damage to people and their things. Fewer people, fewer things. There was one fatality. And a sad one. A child of just 3.5 years old. Asleep. Killed by a collapsing fireplace. Joseph Bishop was his name, visiting Yucca Valley with his parents. There were, additionally, more than 400 injuries. Shop windows exploded, propane fires broke out, one-story buildings were shaken off their slabs or even flattened. And throughout Landers, the earth just opened up gashes across these sandy hills, up to 18 feet across, with vertical displacement of 6 feet in some spots. Canyons opened up in a minute or two of intense shaking. And some homesteaders found their corrals or sheds 6 feet above the rest of the compound. Highway 247, Old Woman Springs Road, a twisting two-lane highway that's the only such thing in or out of Landers. Even the 247 was torn apart. The north end was jolted up and over a good 8 feet. The blacktop crumbled over the break. The water sloshed out of Devil's Hole and Death Valley in swimming pools, not just out in Los Angeles and Orange County, but all the way to Idaho. The geysers at Yellowstone went on a new schedule. And in Landers, there was liquefaction over seismic faults nobody knew existed the day before. Nobody knew they existed. In fact, the geologists were in a wild panic because they believed the Landers quake and its powerful aftershocks were just the beginning of the big one, the overdue San Andreas monster quake that will, one of these days, rip the whole state apart. They expected such a disaster that President Bush, the first one, was rushed back from Camp David to be ready at the White House when hell opened up in Los Angeles. Still in shock from a week straight of riots that burned and scarred L.A. from downtown to Santa Monica. The big one still hasn't happened. And seismologists still don't know exactly what the Landers quake meant. One theory is that the San Andreas Fault itself is being replaced by a series of faults running up through the Mojave Desert and up through the Owens Valley in the Eastern Sierra, home of Mammoth Mountain, which you will remember is a volcano still warming the hot springs at Benton and Travertine. The whole reason these deserts exist is because of the seismic action that created the Sierra Nevada and the San Bernardino and Tehachapi ranges, the massive walls that turned our interior to desert by holding back the clouds, starving this land of water. Deserts are always lands of little rain. But the way it got that way here is by the same method that tore landers apart 25 years ago. The plates of the earth slipping and striking and sliding and smashing against one another. By the way, the Mercalli scale, it measures the intensity of the quake, the effects of the quake here on the surface. It's named for Giuseppe Mercalli, an Italian volcanologist, a Catholic priest, a natural sciences professor at Naples, and the creator of the Mercalli intensity scale for measuring earthquakes. Can you imagine the mind of such a person? A geologist priest. Living a century ago in Italy, at the dawn of modern science, he studied volcanoes by standing on their edges in the hours, he hoped, before, or maybe just after an eruption, the sulfur smoke burning his nostrils, a Catholic priest face to face with the chaotic, molten energy bursting from the ripped seams of the earth itself. The Landers quake was a number 9 on this scale, 9 of 12, violent, and described like this. Damage considerable in specially designed structures, well-designed frame structures thrown out of plumb. Damage great in substantial buildings with partial collapse, buildings shifted off foundations, liquefaction. Now what follows this are 3 levels of extreme, in which railways bend and monuments crumble, stone walls collapse and the bridges tumble into the rivers, and the earth itself can be seen to slump. And then finally, total damage. The landscape moves in waves, in waves. Sight lines distorted, gravity defeated as massive objects, boulders, trucks, trains, are thrown up in the air before crashing down again. Giuseppe Mercalli died in 1914 in Naples at the age of 63. He was burned up, burned alive in his bed. Police later revealed that he was murdered over the equivalent of about $1,400, about a month's rent if you're lucky, then or now. Soaked in gasoline and burned alive. You can prepare for an earthquake, but you can't prepare for that. Anyway, that's a good reminder to get your earthquake kit ready, because it's going to happen one of these days, and you don't want to be cut off with no food, no water, none of your 45 prescription medications. You want to have this stuff together. Now, here are some instructions from the Mormon Church, the Church of Latter-day Saints, headquartered in the Great American Desert in the state of Utah. Our Heavenly Father created this beautiful earth with all its abundance. His purpose is to provide for our needs as we walk in faith and obedience, and He has lovingly commanded us to prepare every needful thing, so that should adversity come, we may care for ourselves and our neighbors and support bishops as they care for others. The Church encourages members around the world to prepare for this coming adversity in life by having a basic supply of food and water, and cash money. Credit cards won't work. ATMs won't work. Now, the church tells people, don't go to extremes. Don't become a survivalist nut. But plan accordingly. Establish a home storage supply and a financial reserve. So, what should you have in your food storage? Well, according to the Mormons, you should have a 3-month food supply and some long-term food beyond that. You should have a water supply and you should have some money. Common sense preparations. Being a responsible adult, I do keep a food supply as well. I bought it off the internet. It's specially made for people trying to follow the Mormon rule to have a 3-month food supply. Freeze-dried foods of all kinds. We've got your beef stroganoff. We've got lentil stew. Pasta primavera, 4 servings. Loaded baked potato, creamy a la king. God, what could that even be? We've got chili mac, vegetable and rotini pasta, cheese and broccoli soup, spicy corn chowder soup, classic chili, white bean chili, lots of beans. Average of 340 calories per serving. GMO-free, 25-year shelf life. I also keep a battery-powered shortwave radio, lots of water, flashlights, toolkit, band-aids, batteries. Don't forget a book or 3 because you probably won't be able to look at your phone. And for psychological well-being, I like to keep 6 or 7 bottles of hard booze and a backup supply of red wine and cold beer. It was the lack of water that kept so much of the American desert from being covered with settlements and mines and farms. And we are lucky to live in a time when so much of the desert has been set aside to stay the way it is. Even as the giant cities, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, Phoenix, Salt Lake, push ever outward, hungry for more land. But as always in the desert, when there is a water supply of any kind, no matter how difficult to reach, how ridiculous to transport, the kind of people who fly in on a charter jet from Orange County or Washington, D.C. are always scheming to take it away. We've got Brendan Mays on the line to talk about this insane plan to dredge up the water from an ancient Mojave aquifer under a national monument.
We're talking about introducing a new non-caloric flavored beverage. We're going to be calling it Mojave Mirage because it has no calories, and that's part of the appeal of it. I'm sure you've seen in all the Costcos and all around the workplaces everybody goes to, there's this thing called LaCroix water, and it's taken the beverage industry by storm. They're growing by leaps and bounds, and we thought, well, you know, with all this Cadiz water, the Cadiz water that we have now that's going to be being pumped up out of the desert, out of the desert floor, that we could maybe get in on this and find a good use for this water instead of exporting it to Orange County. Maybe what we could do is actually bottle it and brand it and export it for sale, do some good, make some money, be using a hell of a lot less water than pumping it out to golf courses in Orange County. We'd be actually making a viable product that people want to buy that's refreshing. It's not bad for you, it's good for you, and would extend basically the brand of the Mojave Desert throughout the world. We see it as a net positive and a good source of income to the local economy. The Mojave Desert is seen as a lack of water, and yet it's sitting on top of billions and billions of gallons of water that's just underneath the surface. It's kind of like a paradox or a mirage. Well, you got to think about what people do when they think about Mojave. They think about the desert. They think about Joshua Tree. They think about purity. That's what they think about. Clean air, dry air, vast open vistas, no people, very little industry, everything clean and pure. That's what we're trying to get at. And you're thinking, desert, well, where's the water in the desert? Well, it's underground. And so what we're doing, and this goes along with the Mirage motif, when you see the desert, when you think about the Mojave, you think about Joshua Tree, and that's what we're trying to sell here. We're trying to sell pure, clean water. It's that paradox that really makes the sell. You think desert, you think no water, but yet here's water from the desert. It's kind of like a little mind trick, and that's what we're trying to exploit. It looks like they're going to be pumping up to 50, 60, 70,000 acre-feet of water with this Cadiz water project. And we thought, well, you know, that's not the best thing, obviously, environmentally, but maybe we could turn this into environmental good, or at least mitigate it somehow, and try to make something good out of it. So we thought, well, they're going to be pumping all this water. There's going to be tons of water coming out everywhere. Maybe we could siphon off some of that and actually turn it into a good product that provides people with refreshment, extends the brand of the Mojave Desert, brings in more tourists, and increases local employment. So that's the approach we're trying to take with this Mojave Mirage brand.
Now, the complaint, as I'm sure you've heard, is that this water feeds springs that provide life-sustaining water to wildlife in our various national parks and national monuments of the Mojave Desert.
Yes. Yes, we're quite aware of the environmental impact. Some scientists say that you can draw a certain allocation of water and not affect spring flows or rates, you know, not affect Cottonwood Canyon or any of the very popular places where water appears in the desert. And other people say that if you take any water at all, you're going to affect things you can't see. We like to think of ourselves as an environmentally conscious brand and people who are interested in protecting our desert. But we also know that this project is going to move forward whether we like it or not. So in terms of trying to mitigate any sort of environmental disruptions that may occur, we do have plans to take some of our water, our spare excess capacity, find any sort of springs that have been disrupted or their flow lessened, and actually bring the water back to those springs. We're going to think, basically what we're thinking of is taking tanker trucks and refilling these local streams and refilling these local springs and other wet spots and other, you know, maybe vernal pools, whatever they got, and putting water back into them with the water that we take out of the pipeline. So that's our plan. Now, of course, we haven't fleshed it out completely, but we're thinking we could take a hands-on, you know, trucks on, take that water out where it's needed and replenish it for the wildlife that needs it to survive.
Now, you do realize that most of these springs that we are discussing here are inaccessible to all but biologists who hack through the growth on foot to measure these flows.
Well, we thought about that too, and we got to say, you know, there's nothing that a drone can't reach. So one of our plans was to, you know, instead of hacking through thickets and trying, you could just take a drone right over with a 50-gallon bucket, a 55-gallon barrel, and just drop the water directly on the site. You don't need to go and hike into every single place. And this is all doable with, you know, with the technology we have today. This isn't even something way off in the future. We could be taking drones and dropping water right where it needs to be. We are firm believers in keeping, you know, the desert protected. And these biologists, who wildlife biologists who go out and study the desert and hack into these springs, we are trying to incentivize them, if they do notice that there's any sort of water disruption or whatever, to actually use them. I don't want to call them like a pack mule or a pack animal, but we could have them actually taking the water with them and replenishing the springs and earning some money, you know, actually giving them a little bit of money, extra money, to bring water into these affected areas, if these areas end up being affected. And that's a big if. Well, The way you do that is you basically take the product and you try to cloak it in a mantle of environmental responsibility. Some people call it greenwashing. We don't like to think of it in terms of greenwashing because that sounds like you just put a thin coat of whitewash on something. You're not really addressing any problems. We want to go deeper than that. We don't want to just greenwash something. We want to green paint it to shield us from the, you know, from the controversy, from the hot magma of controversy that is surrounding this entire project. We think that, you know, by lubricating the local groups, the local desert conservation groups, lubricating with a little bit of money and help with research, we could probably get them to see things, if not necessarily our way, at least to see our point of view and see that we're committed stewards of the desert environment, just like they are, and that we want to work with them, and we don't want to be against them. We don't want to get them angry at us. We want them to see all of the good that can come out of this project. And the good that comes out of this project is manifold. I mean, it occurs with the extension of the brand of the Mojave Desert worldwide and all the wonders within. It's going to get more tourism dollars here, and everybody knows those tourism dollars are very important. And so we think by increasing the awareness of the desert, of the beauty and spectacular nature of that we have here, that we could actually get more tourists coming here and spending their dollars here. Our bottling plant, our also proposed brewing facility, we're thinking of adding up to 60 to 70 local jobs. So we're trying to work with the National Park Service and getting our facility to be built somewhere within the sites of the actual entrance gates to a Joshua Tree National Park. And if it can't be in the national park due to regulations, we can at least purchase private property abutting the national park. We're thinking about maybe setting up a facility on Park Boulevard somewhere. You know, there's a bunch of rundown houses around the area, cars parked all over the place. They look kind of junky, in my opinion. And building a nice, gleaming, modern facility right at the gates of the park. That enforces our brand, and it allows us to basically associate ourselves even more strongly with one of the most popular national parks in the entire world. I mean, everybody knows about Joshua Tree. If you're somebody living around, you know, this area, if you're living in the Mojave, you might have that idea that it's environmentally devastating. But if you don't live here, you're not going to perceive it as environmentally devastating. You're not going to know anything about that. So, you know, and how big is our market here? Our market here is really small. How many people live out here? How many people live in the entire United States of America? 320 million. Now, that coupled with all of the outreach that we've done to the desert conservation community and all the money that we've put into the various projects to try to, you know, gain acceptance of our plans, we think is going to quell a lot of the controversy, if there is any, concerning our particular plans.
You ever take a nice long desert drive and stop somewhere to get out of the truck to stretch your legs and get a cup of coffee, and you're feeling very fine because you're out alone on the beautiful desert, and then there's some old crank at the gas station or looming behind you at the diner counter, and you can feel his eyes on your back, and you just know he's going to start talking to you in particular. And this, friends, is why I carry bear spray in the desert. Here is something that needs to be announced or reannounced. On November 16th, Thursday night, 7 p.m., we will be presenting Desert Oracle Radio live and in person. We announced this on the previous broadcast, but the venue has changed. It's now the Ace Hotel in Palm Springs in the big commune hall, live on stage to be recorded for this very broadcast. Special guests including the Mojave Phone Booth. Yes, a phone booth, or more mysteriously, a feature film replica of the Mojave Phone Booth, now in the care of the Boothmaster and Desert Oracle humorist Doc Daniels. Brendan Mays will surely be telephoning from this same phone booth. There will be other special surprises, guests. Make a night of it, have a cocktail, enjoy the show at the Ace Hotel, Thursday, 7 p.m., November 16th. Many of you have been writing to ask about reserved seating. I will announce those details once they are invented on the next broadcast. Same place, Ace Hotel, hosting our fourth monthly edition of Desert Oracle Campfire Stories outside around a campfire, but don't worry because they also have a camp bar, October 5th, 7 p.m. at the Fire Ring, free and open to all, again on November 2nd and a Wednesday night, December 13th, all at 7 p.m. This program is brought to you by Desert Oracle, the pocket-sized quarterly journal of the American Desert. Become a subscriber and receive four beautiful issues. Send $25 by check or money order to Desert Oracle, P.O. Box 1735, Joshua Tree, California. Subscribe online at desertoracle.com. The blessed autumn equinox has now occurred. Happy autumn to you all, and good night. From the voice of the desert.
If we need any reminders of the majesty and power of earthquakes in our own region, we can look at the story of the Yellowstone earthquake of 1959. I'm going to play you the audio from a YouTube video created by Matt of WeIreInTheRockies.com. And Matt gave me permission to do this. Thank you, Matt. So here's the audio.
One of the things I'm working on is an audio guide for Yellowstone. And so I've been learning a lot about this famous event in 1959, the Yellowstone earthquake, which also goes by the names the Hebgen earthquake and the Madison Canyon earthquake. So I wanted to share some things with you about this incredible event, and I'm going to do so in 10 numbers. So number one, 7.2. This is the measurement, and I have to read this, on the moment magnitude scale. So apparently it's not the Richter scale anymore. I had no idea that this had changed, but it's the moment magnitude scale. And 7.2 is the largest earthquake ever recorded in the Rocky Mountains. This is comparable to the San Francisco earthquake of 1906, that famous earthquake. The epicenter of this was right on the edge of Yellowstone, but the most damage occurred in Madison Canyon, which is about a half hour outside of the park in West Yellowstone, right next to Hebgen Lake. Also, there were a lot of campers in this Madison Canyon. So the Madison River flows through the canyon. There was a couple of campgrounds down there and campers there when the quake happened. Okay, number two is the number eight. This is the number of states that felt this earthquake, including Montana, Idaho, Utah, and Wyoming. Number three, 11:37 p.m. This is the time that the quake hit. So just at night, in the middle of the night, and it was luckily a full moon that night. Everybody commented on what an amazing, clear, beautiful evening it was. And luckily it was a full moon, because when it hit at night, people had to, you know, it was constant, there was a lot of chaos, so they had to kind of figure out where people were and where to go. Number four, the number 40. This is the number of seconds that the earthquake lasted. And when it happened, many people at first, many of these campers down in the canyon, thought that it was a bear attack. They thought their trailers or their tents were being shaken by a bear, because earlier that night, one of the camp hosts had made the rounds and had warned people that there were bears in the area and to be careful. The number number five is number 200. Okay, these are the approximate number of geysers in Yellowstone that went berserk right after the earthquake. Some of the springs that had never erupted before and never have since went shooting sky high. Springs like Sapphire Spring in Biscuit Basin just started going off, geysers going off all over the place. Also, one geyser, Clepsydra Geyser, was dormant. It started going off right after the earthquake, and it hasn't stopped since. The Old Faithful Inn and the Golden Gate Bridge up in Mammoth, they were both damaged during the quake. Some of the park headquarters in Mammoth Hot Springs were damaged, and there were rock slides all over the place throughout the park. Okay, number six is 80 million. This is the number of tons of rock that fell off in Madison Canyon off of the side of the mountain. So it was like a slice of the mountain just cracked off, just a slice of the mountain broke off, and this slice was about almost a mile long, and fell down into the canyon, into the river. It caused mighty winds that some of the people that were there said it tore their clothes off, the winds were so strong. Then it smashed into the river, which caused enormous waves. Waves that swept up onto the shore and swept people, trailers, and even cabins into the water, all of which are still there today. Number seven is the number one. These are the number of lakes that were formed by the earthquake. So when the rock slide came down and hit the river, it dammed up the river, which caused the river behind it, of course, to start to rise. The river had nowhere to go. Now, interestingly, this was only 9 miles downstream from the other dam there, the man-made dam, which is Hebgen Dam, which forms Hebgen Lake. So in effect, this rock slide, which was rocks, mud, trees, the whole thing just came down, plugging up that canyon. In effect, what it did was it created two dams. There was already the man-made Hebgen Dam, and then about 9 miles down was this rock slide with another dam. So in between the Hebgen Dam and the rock slide dam, the Madison River started to rise and rise to form another lake, which is still there today, called Earthquake Lake. There was major concern when the quake first hit that the Hebgen Dam had burst, and so they evacuated some towns downstream. Well, they quickly found out that the Hebgen Dam held remarkably. This dam was built in 1914 and survived this incredible quake, which actually caused Hebgen Lake, one side of Hebgen Lake, to drop a number of feet, which caused this slushing back and forth, like if you were carrying a bowl of water, the water just went back and forth across the way on this Hebgen Lake. In fact, one of the people who had a cabin there on Hebgen Lake, her name was, I believe, Florence Miller. She was a 70-year-old widow. She had a little fishing business there, little business for people to stop in and buy some things. And her cabin, she woke up to the noise, and she ran outside right as her cabin was falling into the water. So part of the road and the cabins there just fell right into Hebgen Lake. She jumped a crevice with her dog, survived as her cabin went floating away into the water. So there were major concern, although Hebgen Dam held, there was still major concern that that would fail, and then also that the new rock slide dam would fail at some point, and that there would just be a flood of water going downstream. Both remarkably held and still are there to this day. Okay, number eight is the number 300. This is the approximate number of people who were trapped between the two dams. As the river was rising, creating another lake, these people were trapped between the dams because the roads from Hebgen Lake, right around Hebgen Lake, had been washed away along with Mrs. Miller's cabin. And so these people were trapped in between these two dams. And as the water was rising, they had to flee to higher ground. And they found a little spot that was higher than both of the dams that they ended up naming Refuge Point, where they waited for rescuers to come. So all throughout the next day, helicopters and smoke jumpers and people were coming to rescue them. Okay, number 9 is the number 28 or 29. These are the number of people who died in this earthquake in Madison Canyon. They have a plaque there with 28 names of the people who died at the site today. It's located on a big boulder right next to the site that tumbled across the canyon, and they didn't move it or anything like that. They just put a plaque on there with the 28 people who died. But there was one person who was hiking that day, that weekend, that evening, and they never saw him again, so there is great speculation that he probably died in the earthquake. These deceased people include one family who, sadly, the two parents slept in their own tent, and they had their three children sleep in their own tent about 15 feet away. A boulder landed on the two parents' tent, crushing them and killing them, as the three children just 15 feet away survived. This is the Stryker family. Okay, number 10 is the number 50,000. This is the number of people who visit the visitor center there each year to learn about this earthquake. So thankfully, the Forest Service recognized what a meaningful, significant event this was, and they built an earthquake a visitor center right there by the rock slide, right there by the new dam. And you know, I camped there earlier this year. I camped right at Beaver Creek, which is right on the shores, or right next to Earthquake Lake, which is also known as Quake Lake. And it's a little bit eerie because there are all these dead trees sticking out of the lake. Well, of course, these trees were just there in the canyon, and the lake filled in and has killed these trees, but they still stick up there out of the lake. It's just a reminder of this incredible event. Okay, and then one more bonus here. So for my 11th number, I just want to put up here many. There were many heroes, a number of heroes involved in the rescue of these 300 or so people who were stranded between the two dams. Hugh Potter, a fellow named Hugh Potter, led the relief efforts from Helena, Montana. He was in charge of a government agency there, and so the state and local governments worked together with the federal government. Airplanes and helicopters from Hill Air Force Base in Utah flew in, and there was just an amazing effort to rescue these people. Bulldozer crews plowed new roads so that people could get in and out within a day. There was great concern that the water was going to plug up so much it was going to burst that rock slide dam, and so over about the next month, they plowed a spillway to go around it. It's still there today. So there were smoke jumpers from the Forest Service who parachuted down into the refuge point to administer relief to the many injured people who were there. There was one woman named Tootie Green who was a nurse. She was camping there, and fortunately she wasn't injured. But when she saw some of these other people who were injured, she started administering relief to them. She became quite a famous hero. And I actually tried to contact her. I looked her up to see if I could contact her for my guides, for some of the stuff I'm working on. And sadly, she died just earlier this year in May of 2020 during the COVID pandemic, and she they weren't even able to have a funeral for her, but she is known to be quite a hero in this whole episode. One fellow from Missoula, Montana, Ray Gerlach, he flew his own helicopter made about 20 trips back and forth to save, to get some of these people to hospitals and to safety. And of course, there were many medical personnel at the hospitals nearby who administered to many injured people. So that does it for this video here. Just a remarkable event that deserves to be remembered. So next time you go to Yellowstone, just kind of, you may be able to go visit this visitor center. It's about a half hour outside of the park in West Yellowstone. Worth a trip to go see this remarkable event and the aftermath that's still there today.
According to the website, the Earthquake Lake Visitor Center is open through September 15th, but they suggest calling them if you're going to pay a visit there, 406-682-7620. A couple days ago, I was driving out of the hills that we live in towards the interstate, and before I got down to the interstate, I noticed a northern harrier, a female, and it was just skimming the tops of the pine trees to my left, following the road, which kind of surprised me. I always think of harriers as flying a lot lower, but, you know, they can fly higher if they want. And it finally went down to the ranch lands that I crossed to get to the interstate. But that was quite a sight to see that raptor so close. Have you been seeing any raptors lately? And now to introduce Steve Hoffman, talking about northern harriers, ospreys, and turkey vultures, we're going to have a word from a northern harrier.
A harrier is just one species in all North America, is the northern harrier. And they have a white rump patch. The juveniles have a rufous or a orangish breast. They have an owl-like face, somewhat slimmer wings, and strong dihedral in the glide, and they also tip a lot, rock back and forth a lot. And they do their hunting by flying low over fields and shrubbery, looking for, you know, birds and mammals. And what's cool is both owls and harriers have asymmetrical ear openings, so they can actually echolocate. So, you know, if you think about it, harriers often hunt in very dense vegetation. They used to be called the marsh hawk because they live in marshes. And you know, marshes are thick. So how do you see a prey item in there? You don't. So, but they can hear it when it's rustling around there. And they can actually find, they've done experiments with harriers in a room completely dark with leaves on the floor and a mouse in there. And that harrier can catch the mouse right away based on locating where the sound is coming from. So that's kind of cool. And owls do that as well. They echolocate because they have asymmetrical ear openings, so they can tell exactly where the sound is coming from. Because that dense vegetation, they need every little tool to figure out where the hell that prey item is. And look how white the male is on under the wing, and looks like the wing tips are dipped in black ink. And look how gray the head is. But otherwise, it's completely white underneath with a gray back. So you have the immatures and females that have the brown back, and the males with the gray back and pure white underneath with the black wing tips. So the adult female is streaked on the breast, but not on the belly, and it's cream colored, whereas the juvenile is orangish colored and no streaking. And here's another adult female with more heavily streaking than this one. And then here's the adult male. And the adult male is the most distinctive. It's really something else. You can't miss that bird. There's nothing you can mistake that for. With the light gray face, the white breast and belly, the white under the wings, the black wing tips, and a long tail. They have a long, really long tail and pretty slim wings, compared to the Pedios. They're slimmer winged than any of the Pedios. The osprey is one of the easiest birds to identify. It's dark on the back and bold white on the breast and belly, and a mixture of white wing lining and dark flight feathers, and a black stripe through the eye. And interestingly, the juvenile ospreys have an orange eye, and the adult ospreys have a yellow eye. Just the opposite as the excipitrids. And if you see, look up, and you see this M-shaped bird flying overhead. That's a high-flying, migrating osprey. So they got these slim wings, real crook in the wing there, and really long wings. They have a 5.5-foot wingspan. I mean, eagles only have a 6.5-foot wingspan, so their wings are almost as long as an eagle's, but they're just a slim bird. They only weigh 4.5-5 pounds compared to an eagle weighing up to 14 pounds. And they will dive underneath the surface of the water as much as 18 inches below the surface of the water to catch a fish. So they actually almost swim after a fish a little bit. But mostly it's just the momentum of them diving and having their feet first going in there to catch the fish. But if they catch a fish that's too big for them to take out of the water, they can drown. They lock into the fish. They cannot open their feet and let go of that fish. They just can't do it. And so some osprey, if they catch a fish that's too large, they're done for. It's been documented many times. Now, one thing you might notice here is look at the little white spots on the back of that young osprey. And the adult doesn't have that. It's all dark on top of the wings and on the back. But the young birds have those little white specks. So that's how you can tell age class. And then look, see the eye is orange, isn't it? It's not yellow yet. Now this is a huge problem, is ospreys like to, you know, decorate their nests. And they can't resist the bright orange color of the baling twine. And people leave baling twine all over their fields. And so ospreys pick it all up, put it in a nest, and then they end up, the young ospreys get caught in their feet, and they end up getting strangled or hang upside down in a tree or whatever it is and die. 15% of the chicks of osprey nests living in agricultural areas die from twine. And actually, a friend of mine, Rob Dominus, sent me some pictures today. He went out with Northwestern Energy, and there was a report of an osprey flying around with twine in his feet. And so Rob went out there, and they got Northwestern Energy brought a truck with a bucket on it, and they went up, and he was able to, and the bird was already flying, and it wasn't caught on anything. But he used a little net, with foot nooses, and the bird just had to step in those nooses, and it did on the nest, and he was able to catch it. So they got it all entangled, and it's going to be in rehab at the Raptor Center here in town for a few days, but it'll probably be released within a few days. They just want to get it fed up and all healthy and get it all healed up, and then they'll let it go. So that was Rob's little job today. Now the turkey vulture. Look for the two-tone pattern under the wings with the black. Look how black the wing linings are here. Totally black. And look how silvery gray the flight feathers are. And of course, it's got a naked head. So the head looks tiny. I mean, the head doesn't even look like it exists in the field at a distance. It's so small. But they have a big 5.5-foot wingspan also, and a very strong dihedral. And they're rocking back and forth all the time, especially in strong winds. Like yesterday, we saw a lot of vultures up on the gravelies, and they were fighting all that strong wind. They were all rocking around everywhere. So it was very easy to identify them based on their behavior in flight. And they don't get their red head till their second year. So if you see Vulture with a gray head, that is a juvenile bird that just hatched this year.
Well, thank you for listening. As always, you can call me and leave a message about anything on your mind, or you can text me. The number is 406-404-6246. Remember to spread the word. You can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. So that's it for today. So till next time, listeners, be safe, stay well, and sweet dreams. So in this episode, we've been talking about some very serious things and some wondrous things. And isn't that what life's all about? Well, I'm going to have Carole King take us out today with a song from her 1971 album, Tapestry, and I'll let the title speak for itself. Enjoy, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Tumbling down, tumbling down, tumbling down.